Hello, and welcome to episode 19 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, Transitions. The end of our previous episode represented one of the rare occasions in this era of Yugoslav football where there was some sort of clean break. Much of a generation bowed out at the 1952 Olympics, with some players who would soon become mainstays of the national setup beginning their journey there. Domestically, competition used the Olympics as the perfect opportunity to break and change to an autumn-spring league. So, while the Hajduk title win of 1952 was odd in terms of format, it would not be something repeated in the 1952-53 season, which reverted back to a standard 12-team league. As mentioned a couple of episodes ago, when we went through the travels and travails of Hajduk, this season would be dogged with controversy over the reaction to Hajduk's mid-season tour of South America, a tour that would end up costing them the points that would have secured them the title. As if to point that out, in the games between the two sides that season, Hajduk would win in Belgrade 4-1. Quite aside from that, the cup final saw Zvezda Fiesta be demolished by Partizan 6-0. And from the evidence that we have from that season, limited though it may be, it's easy to suggest that the team that did win the title, Zvezda Fiesta, were not vintage champions. Below the top tier, the second division would split into multiple regions, 10 in all, which then fed into four sides being promoted to the first league. In this instance, Proletar Osijek, or who are now just known as Osijek, Rabotniki, Radniki Belgrade, and Odred Ljubljana. This format change would last only a season before going back into a fully national league for the 53-54 and 54-55 seasons, before it would finally settle on a format at the end of the decade. That 1953-54 season would see a turnaround in fortunes for Dinamo, and another slightly different schedule, with games that would ordinarily have been played in the spring squeezed in the autumn to ensure preparations for the World Cup would be ideal. This meant that, rather than the cup campaign bookending the autumn, it ended up squeezed in between league games. Dinamo had finished only 7th in the 52-53 season, and were at the bottom of the championship in the truncated 1952 season, still tortured by their dramatic loss of the title from 1951. Perhaps the first thing to touch on in their eventful season would be in the cup rather than in the league, in what became known as the Game of 3 Days. In the semi-finals, they would be matched against BSK. This would be the first season in which penalties would be used in the competition, and, in spite of them being used in the competition previously in the season, as Dinamo had knocked out Partizan 8-5 on penalties after a 5-all draw, they would not be employed to their best effect at Maksimir in the semis. After extra time, the game finished 1-1, and the referee didn't know how to do penalties. The result was that BSK took 5 penalties, then Dinamo took 5. When that finished equal, Dinamo took another 5, and then BSK took another 5. At that point, it was dark, and there were further delays as the teams protested for having to continue when they were unable to see. Dinamo were forced to go again, but after one missed attempt, the game was abandoned due to darkness. The following day, both teams complained to the FA over the incorrect manner in which the penalty shootout was conducted. The result was that Dinamo and BSK were ordered to complete another penalty shootout with automatic sudden death. This lasted all of 4 penalties before Dinamo won and BSK, inevitably, appealed again for a full replay given the amount of whataboutery that had led to them getting knocked out in the first place. Dinamo, to their credit, were amenable to this and wanted the match to be decided on a fairer basis than it was, and, as such, the prior game and shootouts were struck from the record and a replay organised. The result was a 2-1 BSK win en route to them winning the cup overall, under their manager and old friends of the podcast, Blagoj Musa Marjanovic. Even Dinamo's break that season would be eventful, going on a tour of North Africa and playing the French Foreign Legion before hosting Argentina's Racing in a game which had to be ended early after Racing and future Real Madrid keeper Rogelio Dominguez started a fight after conceding the third goal, then promptly ran to the centre circle and spat on the referee. Charming. The title itself came down to two games. Firstly, hosting Hajduk and winning 3-1 in a game preceded by the retirement ceremony for Zvonimir Simančić, the last holdover at the club from the pre-war era. The second was much like 1951, hosting Sveta Zvezda. In front of a full Maksimir, it stayed 0-0 to the final minute before Stojan Ozniak raised up to head in a corner and the ghosts of 1951 were buried at last. A facile 6-0 win over Lokomotiva rounded off the title win. At the bottom, Odred and Rabotniki were relegated to be replaced by NK Zagreb and Zelyeznikar for the following year. It goes without saying that the 2 years from 1952 were ones in which Hungary dominated the international scene. However, Yugoslavia's form was impressive also, as their silver in Helsinki would suggest. 1952 ended with a big win over what was an exceptional Austrian side in Belgrade, followed by a tight loss away to West Germany. 1953 would see the team go unbeaten, including wins away in Belgium and at home over Wales and France. World Cup qualifying would see them paired with Israel and Greece and qualify with ease after four consecutive 1-0 wins, putting them through for their first finals appearance in Europe to the World Cup in Switzerland 1954. Their direct preparations for the World Cup would see an experimental side lose to Belgium in Zagreb before a win over England in Belgrade sent them to the championships in the perfect manner by beating one of the favourites for the cup. The 1954 World Cup was one that created plenty of records. The average goals per game was over 5, primarily thanks to Hungary hammering almost everyone they played, along with a couple of other bizarre results. Obviously, if this was the History of Hungarian Football podcast, then these few weeks in the summer of 1954 would probably be the cause for the most individual examination and angst. Their demolition of West Germany, Brazil and Uruguay on their way to anguished defeat in the final against the Germans is one of the most famous of all the World Cup moments over the past century. Although it's clear now that this was one of the very strongest World Cups in terms of the teams present. Of the last 8, every side aside from the hosts could harbour legitimate ambitions of winning the tournament, and the Hungarian side that were part of those 8 are rated as the best international side in the history of football. As a guide, those 7 sides not called Switzerland in that final stage all possessed ELO ratings that would have them rated as one of the top 6 sides of the decade by average ELO. These were, quite simply, not just the best sides in the world at that time, they were the very best sides in the world of that era. And Yugoslavia would enter an oddly formatted group stage paired with one of the best of them, their old World Cup rivals, Brazil. The squad that travelled the short distance to Switzerland was experienced, yet noticeably different to that of 1950. While that pre-1950 generation was still just about represented in Branko Stankovic, Rajko Mitic, Zlatko Tchaikovsky and Stjepan Bobek, the generation that began in 1950 were entering their peak, such as Ivica Horvat, Badel Vukash and Vladimir Biara. And finally, the names that would carry the side for the rest of the decade were making their World Cup bow, such as Branko Sebec, Toza Veselinovic, Vujadin Boskov and Miloš Milutinovic. The 1954 World Cup groups went as follows. 4 groups of 4 teams, in which, for the first time, everyone actually turned up, in which 2 teams would be seeded, with the seeded sides playing only the unseeded teams. Impressively, These seedings had actually been decided prior to qualification even being completed, with Spain having been singled out as one of the seeded sides. Except Spain were knocked out in qualifying due to losing out in a drawing of lots against Turkey, who could literally attribute their progress to a random blindfolded Italian child. Turkey took over their seeded spot and, presumably, FIFA decided that seeding teams before qualifying was a silly idea that they'd probably best not do again. Yugoslavia were unseeded, which seems a bit bizarre in hindsight given that France, who Yugoslavia had beaten in between the Olympics and World Cup, were seeded. And it would be that French side who were first up in a game that would be refereed by Yugoslavia's 1950 nemesis, Benjamin Griffiths. 1954 was the first World Cup in which television coverage was the norm rather than the exception, and plenty of reports exist of the game, especially as the game actually opened up the tournament. Yugoslavia dominated much of the play, and Milutinovic would be found with space in the box by Tchaikovsky after 15 minutes, slotting the ball home to give Yugoslavia a 1-0 win. Tchaikovsky and Milutinovic would essentially run the game, with Milutinovic later coming close with a bicycle kick. One seed down, one to go. In between their loss in the 1950 World Cup final, an event one Brazilian writer described as like a Hiroshima, Brazil had changed their look, away from an all-white kit into the now iconic yellow strip. Their form was impressive, they'd avenged Uruguay on multiple occasions, and the only team that got one over them were Paraguay, who Brazil had subsequently knocked out of qualifying. Their cross-continental rivalry with Yugoslavia was renowned once again in the Wankdorf Stadium in Bern, no laughing at the back. Refereed by the brilliantly named Scot, Charlie Faultless. Unlike 4 years earlier, the game was alive beyond the first 20 minutes. A tight first half was quickly livened up after the break as Vukaš broke into the Brazil half, laying the ball into the middle to Sebec, who turned his man and drilled a low shot into the opposite corner from 20 yards. Yugoslavia kept the pressure on for much of the remainder of the second half, but Brazil would break from a corner to allow Didi to score a similar goal to Sebec on 69 minutes. The two could not be separated even after extra time. In three World Cup meetings, the record was 1-1, drawn 1, lost 1. Both sides were through to the next round, with Brazil as group winners on goal difference. As peculiar as the big team bias of the group stage was, the draw for the knockout stages would be equally peculiar. Group winners would face each other on one side of the draw, with the runners-up facing off on the other. The system, while odd to modern eyes, threw up some incredible games of which Yugoslavia were probably involved in the least crazy. Uruguay defeated England 4-2 after having stuck 7 goals past a managerless and utterly shambolic Scotland in the group. Austria and Switzerland finished 7-5 to the Austrians in the highest World Cup game, scoring World Cup game of all time, in 40 degree heat, with the Swiss going 3-0 up before the heat took its toll. Brazil, meanwhile, ended up against Hungary in what became known as the Battle of Bern. Played in torrential rain, Hungary's eventual dominance and a controversial penalty saw Brazil players lose their heads completely, with fights both on and off the pitch, as it descended into a war to be endured rather than a match to be enjoyed. West Germany and Yugoslavia met in what was, by the comparative standards of the other quarterfinals, a relatively tame affair. The Germans would take an early lead after a high ball in the box would be diverted by an off-balance Horvat beyond Beara into his own net. Much of the rest of the first half saw Yugoslavia on the attack, with several chances shared across the team, and a heroic diving header goal line clearance in the second half prefaced almost continuous pressure on the German goal. The Germans would then break on 85 minutes, with Helmut Rahn finishing on the angle to put them through to the semis and send Yugoslavia home. The Germans, of course, went on to defeat Hungary in the final to win their first World Cup. For the second World Cup in a row, the final would be a match that would result in almost a sort of national mourning, with spontaneous protests in Budapest. For Yugoslavia, it was yet another case of so near yet so far. They were by no means disgraced by the Germans, as this transitional team achieved relative wonders in avenging 1950 against Brazil and in putting together an excellent mesh of generations that showed that they still belonged as one of the world's very best international sides. Next time on the podcast, we hurtle into the mid-1950s as European football becomes recognisable as European football for the first time. The European Cup is coming. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.